This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 5th of October, 1955. The title of this lecture is Smoothness of Auditing. This lecture is 63 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
The Smoothness of Auditing. The methodology of auditing smoothly. Auditing is calculated to produce a better ARC in the preclear. That is all that auditing is calculated to do. It has no mechanical goals. Since if it has any mechanical goals, these goals then begin to take precedent over ARC in the preclear. Quite important for you to know then that we are seeking a gradient scale of ARC in the preclear. And auditing wins when ARC betters in the preclear and loses when it worsens. And by modern techniques, there is really no reason of any kind to get a reduction of ARC in the preclear, even for a moment. And if you do a thoroughly smooth auditing job, ARC will always be on the increase and never on the decline. You can measure the quality of an auditor today by this smoothness of gradient. And you can find what he has done wrong by the number of times the gradient has been interrupted. It's very important. What we are doing today, we are doing with sufficient smoothness that at no time is there any necessity to create an enormous effect upon the preclear. Now, there are two directions that you could audit. One is to increase the ARC of the preclear, and the other to produce an effect upon the preclear. Increasing ARC is what we call a result. Producing an effect is simply being emphatic. We're saying, "Your preclear!" Exclamation point. Now, there are bad auditors of the early days, there are numerous records of processes which were developed and used, which were bad processes run by bad auditors. And there's only one common denominator to all of them. They produced a resounding effect upon the preclear. And they produced no increase of ARC in the preclear. Now, having this weapon or measuring stick in hand, your training criteria, when you yourself are training auditors, and you will be training auditors, is whether or not the auditor produces a consistent gain of ARC. The criteria is, if he does that, he's a good auditor. He's a better auditor the steeper the gradient. And he's a poorer auditor the flatter the gradient. But he's a bad auditor if his preclear is doing very much of a roller coaster. Up, down, steep dives, shallow climbs. Steep dives, shallow climbs. Now, there are a great many little things to know about keeping this gradient as steep as possible and yet as much in ARC, in the ARC category as possible. There's a great deal to know about it. And the funny part of it is today we can articulate what we know about it. It's quite interesting that we can do this because ARC is just ARC. Now, theoretically, you could stand there and be so bright and so cheerful that the pre-clear would then boost his ARC to such a level that he would exteriorize. You get this? I mean, you could be so much in ARC yourself that the pre-clear would simply go into ARC. That is known as a magnetic personality. Just why they put the word magnetic in there is a matter of grave suspicion, since we feel that there is some pitch involved by which the thetan is supposed to snap terminals with you or something. You know? So here we have, however, the sphere of influence of the individual. Now, the sphere of influence is actually not an area or cubic measurement, but it can be looked upon as such. Now, we find somebody is able to influence things as far away as he himself can reach them with his body's hands. Got that?
Yes.
See? But some people don't even have this much sphere of influence. Some people only have the sphere of influence of maybe their nose. Some people don't even have that much influence. They're interiorized and not controlling the mock-up at all. But the average fellow that succeeds has a sphere of influence which is considerably wider than his fingertip reach. That's pretty much on the average. He can do it by persuasion, ordinarily, of communication. See, that gives him an extended sphere of influence. And actually, the great sphere, as far as he would be concerned, would be as far as he could write a letter. See? But it'd be an awfully thin line to the point where the letter lands. You see this? But let's look at something else. This individual is using MEST, in each case, to widen his sphere of influence. When a government is no longer capable of influencing the course of events in hostile nations, it invents things to fire shells. And we notice that it fires heavier and heavier shells with greater and greater range, with more and more destructive effect, in order, the damn fools, to increase their sphere of influence. Oh, no. Nobody ever enlarged his sphere of influence with MEST. But the more and the heavier MEST he uses, the smaller his own sphere of influence becomes. So we're dealing with two spheres of influence. We're dealing with the MEST-wise sphere of influence, and we're dealing with the theta-wise sphere of influence. And we're not talking about mysticism even vaguely. Let's examine this other sphere of influence. You could, of course, theoretically influence things to the degree that you could be 3 feet back of their heads. Let's look at that as a kind of a mechanical look. Somebody is busy sticking a gun in your ribs and demanding your wallet, like they do on television. You flip 3 feet in back of his head, and he puts the gun in his pocket and walks away. See, you could envision being 3 feet back of a body's head and exerting a direct and immediate command control upon that body, which was hostile to the body you most favored. That would be a sphere of influence, wouldn't it? Well, that sphere of influence increases to the degree that you are not hiding, protecting, owning exclusively one point of MEST, a body. You see? Now, the more you are protecting the body which has the gun thrust into its ribs, the less you will get behind the other fellow's head and give him the orders. Now let's take this up a gradient scale. We are not particularly protecting the body which has the gun thrust in its ribs, and so we are quite easily back of the other fellow's head. And he puts the gun away to the degree that you are willing to be him and his motives. All right. Let's carry it up just a little bit further. There are two fellows standing there, one whom has a gun in the other's ribs. And we consider this an antisocial action, so they both walk away. Get this now? All right, we more or less own both of them, don't we? Well, let's go up just a little higher. And we decide that people shouldn't go around sticking guns in people's ribs, so we influence the sphere of influence. We extend that sphere of influence to the entire criminal population. And then we extend it to all of the citizenry. Well, we've got a game going now, but we see that the misbehavior on a marital level on the part of the citizenry, the misbehavior of the local community with regard to education, the misbehavior of the newspapers and mediums of propaganda of the society, all add up to a criminal element. You see this very clearly. But if we were all those and the criminal element too, you know what would happen? You know what would happen if we got a sphere of influence going that high? Till we could actually control all the citizenry and all of the criminals and all of the communication lines in that particular community? We wouldn't have to do it. You know what we'd have to do? Smile. You get the idea? Now, there would be an upward gradient of sphere of influence. So you were just raising it up. And we get more and more control, but we get less and less partisanship. So control goes down as partisanship sets in. And the more partisanship we have, the less control we have. And that's one of the answers to influence. All right. Let's get very practical now. Let's take the auditor who is sitting there totally unwilling to be that preclear. What is his sphere of influence over the preclear? He is protecting his own reactive bank from restimulation. He is hoping the preclear won't breathe on him again, etc., etc., etc. What's his influence upon the preclear? It's pretty low. It's pretty low. At this moment, he expects and intends the magic spells called techniques to somehow or other unravel the bank of the preclear without any intervention of his own. Now, a little bit above that, perhaps he's in there trying. That's a lovely word, you know, trying. To intention, you add force and you get trying. So he's in there trying to get the preclear up there, and he's adding that to techniques. What do you know? That even that's a little bit better than just sitting there and you know, I don't want to be this guy, and if I just utter these magic incantations, preferably back of my vocal cords, not front of them. Well, I will then have a sphere of influence here. Oh no. You know where that sphere of influence winds up? Shooting the preclear. You know, if you start in that line, protecting your body as an auditor, and if we more and more protect, and if we fend off more and more, and we depend more and more upon mass communication to do this thing for us, the end result is getting mad at the preclear, getting peeved with him, deciding he's no good anyway, deciding you really were at fault, you didn't want to do anything for him. In other words, we get a decline of sphere of influence. Now, if we're processing him and we're quite relaxed about the whole thing, and we're not busily protecting ourselves or our reactive bank, so it starts to fly to pieces, you know, kind of the attitude, so what, you know? We are not directly monitoring or puppetizing the pre-clear, but we're just relaxed, and we are using speech to relay our meaning to the pre-clear. Now we're getting a difference, aren't we? We're using speech to relay our meaning to the pre-clear because the dumb cluck has decided, you see, that he has to have it in order to perform. All right, so we go in that agreement, but we're kind of not entirely there as an auditory. See, and we're not trying either particularly. There's no force being added here. We've got an expectancy. We expect the pre-clear to go on upscale, and everything goes along beautifully. We also, oddly enough, increase his self-determinism because we're waiting for him to make various decisions. But he's not making these decisions in an hostile atmosphere. He's making these decisions in a perfectly friendly atmosphere. And so he'll make them. And he'll go on up the line. He'll change his mind. And his sphere of influence will broaden, too. It's the way we go about it. There's a little law lurking around in here, which is a fascinating law. It is that ARC is depressed by MEST. And the more one seeks to imply MEST in the creation of a change of state or mind on the part of another, the less ARC there is. I'm sorry if it's an uncomfortable law. I mean, it's we'd have an entirely different Scientology if our intention was simply to build something pretty that patted us all on the back, you know. Every once in a while, I run across the most violently antipathetic laws and rules, and I say, "Oh no, no, that's." It's bad. Think if this thing got out. Think if people started operating this way, you know. Think if they understood this, what had happened to the game. Well, I just guess I can kick overboard my influence on that guy. You know, he knows this law too. You know, so I say, oh well. All right, what the hell. Give it up. Just have to put that cat of nine tails away, and it whistled so nicely. So, here we have this horrible fact. You see this fact in operation all the time, if you wish to look. That the more MEST you employ in bringing about a change of mind on the part of a pre-clear, or a group, or a relation, or a nation, the less ARC there is going to be. If your own sphere of influence is poor, do you know that you can write people several letters and wind up by cutting the communication line? Did you know that? Did you ever start a little tiny disagreement through the mail? You know? And you said, well, I will at least object to this one little insignificant point. Certainly I can do that safely. And then the next thing you know, this fight's got 100 men on both sides and they're using guns, you know, that sort of thing. How the dickens did this happen? Well, let's write some more letters. And we haven't got a good two-way communication line there at all because they're not being regularly replied to, and maybe letters are going, and then additional letters are going before the letter which went is replied to, and you get a tumble on the communication line and a confusion on the line. And you finally say, damn you, get in the line, do this. No communication line. We just kept adding MEST into the line one way or the other, or threat of force, or duress, or strain, and the line blew up. It's as easy as that. Simple. We look this principle over, and we discover that there's only one saving grace for the use of speech at all. The that speech is employed in communication, and that communication is the universal solvent of mist. So therefore, we dare let communication sag a little bit into mist, as long as its intention is ARC. But the moment we start using mist and communication in conjunction and shift the intention the other way, it goes to pieces in a hurry and ceases to be communication and becomes a bullet. Communication, mist-wise, with a bad intention behind it, with the intention of punishing or reducing the survival value of another, rapidly solidifies into bullets and brickbats, and then solidifies from something as active as a bullet just to a lump. And this is what the final result is. We start an argument with someone. It's not safe. It's not safe to start an argument. It sounds that, anybody ought to be able to get in there and argue. But a law is being perverted here. And that law is that the more mist enters into the communication line, the less AR there is in the line. And then the less C, and the less AR, and then the less C, and then less, and boom. You think it's real safe to argue? Well, it's not safe to argue at all. Unless you simply like to argue. And if you're doing it as a game or a sport or something like that, well, for heaven's sakes, go on and argue. But don't do it to communicate or to try to change somebody's mind. Because people's minds do not change when they're argued with. Their mind solidifies into the opinion which they held previously. We got that?
Yes.
Now, why does it do that? It does that because we have entered the intention to reduce survival into a communication line which has created mist. In other words, we're actually trying to create mist at the other end of our communication line. And the net result is, eventually, is to have no communication. The only pay there is in the whole universe is communication. It's the only payroll there is. And the only real punishment there is in the entire universe is a lack of communication. Now, what would you think of somebody who finds communication very distasteful? Somebody walks up to him and says, "How are you, Joe?" Isn't like that. The poor devil can't be paid. He's off every payroll in the universe if he dislikes communication. And then the darn fool starts to collect pounds or dollars or francs. They're no good to him. Because if he's cutting communications to that degree, as they inflow, they simply solidify. And we get him holding on to money, you see. Which is real cute. Money itself ceases to be communication. In other words, every slightest vestige of communication which comes in this person's direction from a certain point down then solidifies and goes out of communication. And we're getting less and less and less communication, even though he has more and more and more communication unit potentials. He might start buying guns. He might start buying bombs. He might do all kinds of things. But the more of these things he acquires, the more round figures he acquires in his bank book, the more possessions he acquires, the more stenographers he hires. You see, it just wouldn't matter how much he acquired. Every single one of them would solidify and cease to communicate. Now, where is he on the make-break point? Where is that make-break point, rather? Just exactly, where does he cease to be paid and start to be penalized? Let's look at the overt act motivator sequence. The intention of his communication has all too frequently been to reduce the survival potential of the other terminal. So we get down to it. What is the only overt act that really counts? There's just one overt act. Oh, you can go around and shoot people and forget their birthdays and do all kinds of things, forget the anniversary. You can do all kinds of wild and horrible things, but actually there's only one overt act. And that is changing the intention of a communication from survive to succumb. Now, knowing that, by the way, you could probably, one way or the other, run out all the overt acts of an individual. Straighten them out like that. It doesn't matter much how we would go about it. We could use even native state first, second postulate theory to do this, you see. What don't you know about bad communication is a crude process that comes immediately to mind. Anything like this. But this individual has hit the make-break point of intending that live thing called communication to bring about a dead thing, and so has perverted the intention of communication, with, of necessity then, the curtailment of the affinity and reality. And this is then the beginning of solidification of all communication particles. And from that point on, he slides in a hurry. It's a rather dreadful punishment, as a matter of fact. But the fellow is doing it to himself. So when you walk up to somebody on the street and you say to him, how are you? You don't ask him a question they just normally answer those. You just say, how are you? And the fellow goes, Your next question might be, and very well might, when he finally realized what you'd asked him, put tears in the man's eyes. When did you try to kill somebody with communication? He wouldn't absorb it right away. Probably some days later, he'd pick this thing up. He'd say, don't like that. Don't like that at all. Then he realizes that he has talked at his wife and he has talked at his friends in an effort to shut them up. That's all that's necessary. Let's talk at people in an effort to shut them up. We'll get a reversal of this cycle. See, we take the universal solvent and then we do this inexplicable thing with it. We make it solidify. Oh, no. This is one of those horrible things, you see. You have just one universal solvent, and then we throw it all away. We just have one solvent that will take care of one's sorrows and ills and deadnesses and upsets. Just one, you see. And we take this, and we carefully fill it up full of carbolic acid and other pleasant poisons. And all of a sudden, we don't have any universal solvent anymore. And when we first start to use it again as such, it behaves rather peculiarly and starts tearing us up most alarmingly. I'm not warning you about using communication badly. Go ahead, I mean, your life. There's really no real active and instant penalty connected with it. But we're apt to believe that the overt acts, which are really overt acts, are shooting somebody through the brisket. What is this but communication gone that solid, that's all. And you could go ahead and run this out, and a fellow would feel better, but he wouldn't be very well, because the sin, if there is such a thing, and we do have found a sin, the sin on the track occurred much before then. The fellow perverted a communication line by intending succumb at the other end of the line. In other words, he went on then pretending it was communication, but it couldn't have been communication because the end result was supposed to be succumb. And he's just got these two things crossed, and as soon as he starts doing that, he does it more and more and more. Of course he'll wind up shooting somebody. I mean, that's just one of these inevitable consequences that occur, such as you drop matches in tanks full of gasoline vapor. They explode. Just an expected reaction. It's just that inevitable. All right, now let's scold a preclear into getting well. We're going to do it? This is raise hell with them until they finally realize that they've got to change. You solidify their existing state. You solidify whatever's there. All right, an auditor then gets the best auditing result when his intentional background is survive for the preclear. He intends the preclear to survive. And it's an amazing thing how many auditors simply put this on automatic. Just put it on automatic and say, well, now I'm just an auditor and I just go on auditing. I go on auditing. You'd get an interesting result on an auditor who did this. If you were to run give me some intentions about preclears. And the guy would bog and sag. And one auditor I ran this on did an amazing thing. This auditor would rather have been dead than to have exteriorized anybody. Because you exteriorize one of these beasts, these Satans, they're liable to do almost anything. And yet, we couldn't bring this auditor to do an exteriorization on a case. He always had something wrong. You know, he'd always drop his shoe or the ashtray or suddenly use R-245. He actually would have used R-245 before he would have really exteriorized somebody. And we looked around in an effort to establish why more exteriorization was not being done. Well, of course, one of the reasons it was not being done is because we didn't know about not knowing. That was one of the reasons. The techniques were not entirely adequate to the job. That was one reason. Yet, nevertheless, an auditor with a good, clear-cut survival intentions toward the preclear does this great oddity of exteriorizing about 50% of the people he runs into. See, he just says, be 3 feet back your head, and they are. It's an interesting thing. But they exteriorize a very large number of people, averaging out the populations of the world. By the way, in Australia, everybody exteriorizes, I'm told. They just go out back of their head, bang, with no reality. Space. Tremendous spaces these people have, and they exteriorize with the greatest of ease. What they're trying to do is interiorize. They're trying to get some mass around there to live with. It's very amusing. I've just been told that by a couple of auditors so far, by an American auditor and a former director of training here. Anyway, why then do some auditors, knowing just as much as these other auditors, get no exteriorizations or get very, very few of them? Or if they get any, louse them up. Why do they do this? Well, they're just doing it on an automatic. It's not an articulated thing for them. They rather believe that their intentions are pretty good, except they've never examined them. An examination's the intention toward the preclears in general. And you'll find some guy all of a sudden with an unknownness there, sitting there, of a tremendous reservation about doing anything for anybody. They did anything for anybody or changed anybody upscale at all, they would then be guilty of all the crimes which this individual would then... One fellow I ran into knew that auditing would produce an uninhibited condition. Knew that auditing would produce this condition, and therefore that anyone he audited would become immoral. He didn't have any inkling, by the way, that these were his intentions. He just knew there was something that made him nervous about auditing people. It's made him pretty nervous, too. Now, if we ask a person that question, we'd also have to ask him to assign some intentions to pre-clears. Assign some intentions to yourself, you'd get more or less the same result. Or what don't you know about pre-clears' intentions, or what don't you know about your intentions? Anything you want to do with it. The principle of the thing is what we're talking about here. Now, the production of an even gradient is not an art anymore. It's a very precise science. It means that you must produce minimal, sudden change with your auditing commands and two-way communication. Minimal, sudden change. Why is this? Change and time are not exactly, but could be considered for our purposes, synonyms. Change and times are synonyms for our purposes. So that any sudden changes create some time in the pre-clears bank. And they put time on an already existing time track. And they leave time bracketed with no time and no time. So he was getting no time, and then suddenly time, and then no time. Nothing floats and misbehaves in his bank. It's liable to float along with him. It'd be kind of going tick, tick, tick on its own, you see. Well, how would you do this? The only way you could do this and make this change stick in the bank in this fashion, I just told you. The only way you could really do this would be to miscommunicate in some fashion. You skid on two-way communication 2, 3, 5 minutes, or even a half an hour later, pre-clear skids and does a sudden change. For better or for worse, they do a sudden change. But you had to skid first as an auditor. You slipped. And the way you slipped was into an unthought intention of some sort, or just a mechanical misbehavior on two-way communication. An inadequate thing, you didn't quite catch the originated communication, you muffed it in some fashion or another, you didn't keep enough communication going, and all of a sudden your pre-clear will get a radical change. Well, you're giving him a stuck point right there. Quite interesting. If his intention was not the intention it is during an auditing session, of course he would get no real effect from this at all. So in common life, casual life, you can chatter along and muff it and skip it and do all sorts of things with communication without any effort. But remember, you're the auditor. You're assuming a considerable amount of responsibility. There's a considerable amount of agreement going on here, one kind or another. And all of a sudden, one way or the other, you give too little communication. Or you ball up the communication in some fashion, bringing about then a change. Now, what if you changed suddenly with no communication bridge? Supposing we were going along this way, we were saying to the pre-clear, all right, let's spot some objects here in this room. Let's spot some more objects in this room. Okay, now let's spot some more objects in this room. And now tell me something you don't know about your mother. Doesn't look like a gradient to me, does it to you?
No.
You know what happened to your pre-clear? You go, stick. Why? while you changed. Now, if he's going to get a change, just purely and simply because he has been insufficiently two-way communication with, and he's going to get a sudden change for better or for worse, and when I say a sudden change for better, I mean a manic. He's going to get a sudden inflow of some engram that tells him he's wonderful and gorgeous and handsome, and it's going to last for minutes, or at the most 3 or 4 days. See, and then wear out suddenly. All right? He's going to get a sudden change. You're going to stick him with that. Or, worse, you do a sudden change. Now, get this idea. Supposing he were being audited by you, and then he happened to look around, and you were wearing a space helmet. Sort of mild. It would startle him. And let's look at what happens when he gets startled. He experiences a sudden change, doesn't he? That's all being startled is, or being surprised. You've got a sudden change that you didn't know about. And the sudden change comes about because of the introduction of an I don't know. So we get I don't know and sudden change combined together, and boy, do we stick a preclear. So to keep this gradient going, you give him warning. And you're coming down the track about 2 miles away from this process that you're now going to run on him. You signal ahead and get the gates closed, and you run out a couple of flags on the cowcatcher, and you pour a lot of black smoke out of the stack, and ring the bells and blow the whistle, and send a couple of watchmen up front to flag down all the traffic, and they just square it all around, and by the time you come to that crossing and so forth, do you know that he has actually predicted and established the fact within himself that something else was going to happen here? Something was going to occur that was different. And he's all set for it, and he just goes over it with the greatest of ease. Now, how do you do all these things in actuality? Well, in the first place, you tell him, I don't care how bluntly, now, that process, which we have just, it doesn't matter how tinily you're going to change the process. You're just going to run it from square objects to round objects. We're running square objects, and we say to him, now, that process of spotting these square objects is now going to end. And now you find it ending, and now it's almost ended. Now it's stopped. That's the end of that process of spotting square objects. Now, how do you feel? How are you? How's your mother? How's your aunt? How's your sister? How's your cowcatcher? Tell me, have you had any changes at all? Things look good to you now? How has this auditing seemed to you? Are you feet tired? You're standing there all right? Well, that's fine. Just acknowledging everything back and forth. Good, good, lots of communication. And now you sort of hint. You say, in a very short space of time, we may get on to another process. Now, how are you? And have you had any tea lately? And are you getting hungry? And how is life treating you? And that's very fine. Well, that was a very witty observation, and that is swell. Now, you better brace yourself a little bit here, because we're going to get on to this next one very shortly. And, well, that's fine. Well, now, you felt all right about that other. Well, now, all right. Okay, now, let's go. Now, we're going to change this process, and let's now spot some round objects. That's what we're going to do now. Is that all right with you? Oh, it is. That's fine. All right. Now, are there any round objects in this vicinity? Get the idea?
Yeah.
We snuck up on the stop. We bridged with two-way communication from the stop to the next start. We snuck up on the start. And then, after we had rung every bell in sight and turned on all signals everywhere, we started. The idea? We didn't get any change in the bank. See? Got no sudden change. And if we do this very expertly and smoothly, it doesn't take us very long. It doesn't take large pieces of time, you know. We're just in good ARC with him anyhow, and we just move it over into that and so forth. And if you were to scan the pre-clearance bank, he would say, oh, yes, that was a very smooth writing session without any changes in it. Now, if you did this very expertly, you could run from spotting objects in general to spotting the number of times his grandmother beat him. See, actually just wham, wrench. See, as a process, from an objective to a subjective process, from present time and future back to past. Entirely different time process. We could even say it in a different voice or anything else. We could say it with a different demeanor and so forth. And if we'd put enough bridge in between the stop of the last process and the start of the next one, we would have then no real awareness of change at all. Okay, we wouldn't get any violent reaction on the part of the individual. Now, that's why we flatten a process before we change to a new process. Because this phenomenon exists very nicely, that an individual does a nice time track walk on you while you're running a straight wire process or any kind of a process. This is the oddest thing you ever saw in your life. They do this just as mathematically as though they were calculated by Einstein. Here we go, you see. Present time, they spot. We don't care if they're spotting objects. Their bank goes from present time back a little bit into the past, more into the past, more into the past, more into the past, more into the past, little less into the past, little less, closer to the future, present time. Into the past, into the past, into the past, into the past, less into the past, less into the past, less into the past, closer to present time, present time. The odd part of it is I use present time there on an hour-wide basis. See? So they're not quite in present time at any one of these times. And then we, again, get this time track march. And we don't care if we're just spotting objects. If you were to look into his head, you'd find him somatic strip and so forth. We're all performing these functions very neatly. Then he starts in, and we start asking him to spot more objects. And he goes into the past, way into the past, way into the past, way, way, way into the past, you know. And then not so much, not so much, not so much, not so much present time. And now we ask him. His reactions, by the way, are almost proportional. The length of time it is taking him to reply is not an exact, but a measure of the distance he is in the past on that subject. There's a little law about that. It takes an hour to answer. He's picking it out of something 5 million years ago, believe me. And he'll gradually work on up present time and give it to him. Now, he goes further and further and further and further and further into the past. In the early stages of the process, as it approaches its greatest depth, you might say, how many years behind is he? We're just spotting things, you understand. His bank is doing all this. And then as we keep on doing it, he's less and less in the past, less and less in the past. And when the process is flat, entirely and completely flat, he probably would not vary a millisecond out of present time. See, he'd be present time, present time, present time, present time. But as it approaches that, the band narrows, and he is half an hour. He's going back into the past a half an hour and up. Half an hour and up. See? And then he's going back into the past 10 minutes, 3 minutes, 2 minutes. Millisecond, 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 millisecond. And boy, it'll be flat. He'll be going bang, 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 bang. Now, of course, if he is in present time, he isn't handling any heavy energy mass with relation to this sort of thing, and a sudden change would produce minimal effect upon him, wouldn't it? So if we suddenly changed the process on, if he's totally in present time, we'd still be fairly safe. But remember that we changed. So he'd better make a bridge there. And let's give him ample warning so we don't give him a sudden switch. With an I don't know in it, you know? And we would then give him ample warning and go on to another process. So there's two ways of going about this then, isn't there? And the funny part of it is, if we were smooth enough and adroit enough and we're in enough ARC with the world at large and had a big enough sphere of influence, we could take an individual that we had just put 76 trillion years in the past and do this horrible thing, change the process on him. And he would experience no great upset because of this. But boy, you'd certainly have to be good. You'd certainly have to be good. You would have to slide in the fact that you were going to change the process slowly enough and smoothly enough so that he would have a chance to drop the other process. See? And leave it parked back there 76 trillion years. You could do it. But man, it'd be the knee plus ultra of auditing to get away with it. If you did it just halfway well, he'd stick right there, 76 trillion years. See? Another auditor would come along, start to audit him. Fellow would have an hour and a half comm lag. And auditor would wonder, what on earth is going on here? My goodness, it must be very significant. Let me see. Yeah, it's very significant. Somebody switched the process on him when he was deep in a comm lag. That's what's significant about it. Fortunately, processes are sufficiently good today that we can cut this to pieces without too much trouble. But it's a boo-boo, and it'll cancel out the value. Well, if done two or three times in an auditing session, it can just be counted on to cancel out the total value of the session and even kick the pre-clear back down a bit. You see, he interprets it that your intention must be for him to succumb. You broke off a process, didn't complete a cycle, changed the thing without much warning, and he just says to himself, whether it's true or not, maybe it's just carelessness or tiredness on your part, but he just says to himself, this person doesn't care whether I live or not. In fact, probably intends to kill me dead. This is why psychiatrists don't make people well. Your intentional line, this violent effort to change with mess, you know. Let's get in there real heavy with those electrodes, and if we can knock his brain cells apart far enough, we'll fix him, we'll show him we can change him. They don't win. Auditor comes along and audits that mess, and it's a mess. Of course, one psychiatrist informed me one time. He told me, he said, you know, I've been reading some of your work. Of course, it's so colloquially written that I really can't read it. I almost laughed in his face because he doesn't know his own publications. I don't know if you guys have ever read psychiatric publications, but they don't communicate. Not just to me. They don't communicate to psychiatrists. And they are full of the wildest statements. Direct quote. Direct quote. When a kleptomaniac fails to steal something, he always burns down the house. You know that I'm kidding you now, don't you? You know that that thing couldn't possibly exist, huh? When a kleptomaniac steals something successfully, she always has an orgasm. These are scientific psychiatric facts. Put out as smoothly as anything you ever saw in a textbook. So this guy tells me he can't read my stuff because of it. And also because my generalities are too great. Also claims are too great, psychiatric claim. 75% of all patients who were sent to the hospital recovered. Recovered what? All right, we look this over and we find out that the psychiatrist has no intention with regard to the patient to amount to anything. There are a few people in psychiatry who do work delicately, who do communicate well, and who do produce good results on people. See, there are some. But the boy who will use the scalpel and the electric shock and so forth, just intends to kill somebody. That's all he intends to do, and he succeeds. He succeeds at such a percentage that I think anybody who did that could probably be tried successfully for murder because it is nowhere allowed by law. Not even by custom. The public just doesn't know about it, that's all. So we look over this operation, and we find out that the use of this much violence upon another human being must thereby react as a violent intention for the other person to succumb. And even if the intention weren't there, if the psychiatrist had read right straight down the line in his textbook 100% that this was the thing to do and it would make the person well, nevertheless, the communication which registers with the patient is the violence of electric shock. And the violence of that registry is sufficient to wipe out any intention beyond the actual intention of that much collision, which is die. So what are you dealing with when you handle a patient who has been in psychiatric hands and has been much electric shocked and metrazoled and drugged and so forth? What are you handling? You are handling somebody who has been made to experience violent changes while regressed on the track. Got that? And when we know we can stick a preclear with the best of intentions simply by asking him an insufficient number of times an auditing question, by not flattening a process, we can stick a preclear. Think of how you should be able to stick a preclear with a couple of electrodes. You see that we're doing much the same thing, but much heavier. Now, the oddity is that the consequences are not comparable. For another reason. They're not quite comparable. There's another reason involved. You are a Scientologist. The preclear has hopes of what will happen. The preclear has a definite conviction of your intentions and believes these intentions to be very, very good. Therefore, the dismaying of this intention by a careless piece of auditing reacts with tremendous violence because it invalidates his prediction of intention. It invalidates it. Maybe the only thing he's got left, really, as far as life is concerned, is the fact that a Scientologist can fix him up. There are a lot of people around like this. Don't know anything much about Scientology, but they know something good about it in a vague sort of way, and they hope that it will help. And this hope that it will help is what is dismayed by a bad piece of auditing or a betrayal of some kind during that auditing, you see. If the individual went into an institution knowing he was going to get clobbered with no expectations of getting anything else, knowing his brains were going to be fried and so on, it's minimized. You see? Soldier goes into battle, he doesn't expect the enemy to do anything else but shoot him. So when the enemy shoots him, it's no great invalidation. He knew what he was expecting. So what we've gotten here is a twist on intention. And that can exist to the degree that an individual has put out an ARC line himself to meet the other ARC lines. And when he hasn't put one out, he's not really in communication. Got it?
Yes.
See, that's where expectancy. He expects to communicate and he doesn't get a chance. This is horrifying. You know, waiting is very bad, but expecting a communication and not getting one is murder. Now, that's fabulous. That does more people in. They just wait there and wait for that communication, and it doesn't come, and it doesn't come. And by the way, that makes me feel guilty sometimes because the letters hit my desk at the rate of 80 to 100 a day, 7 days a week, and along about Monday or Tuesday. Oh, man. Somewhere in that, there will be four or five emergencies for which this mail has to be combed. And if it's not combed, Lord knows what will happen someplace. See? So the emergencies are selected out and set right one way or the other, instantly or immediately. It's done quickly. The other things which are of importance to other areas, some comment is made on it. And before I know it, sitting back there on the back of the desk, will be maybe 400 or 500 letters, which are casuals. Ron, how are you? Thank you. Something of this character. Try to see if they get answered. But all too often they don't. it's just not possible to answer that much volume from one point. Now, the trouble of it is, if any of these applied to any other department in Scientology, any of this male volume applied to any other part of Scientology, it would be a different problem, don't you think? But that's already been screened for that. Book orders, applications, technical information, these things are all out of it already. And it gives me an awful guilty conscience. I sit there and look at that stuff, and I say, oh, no. And finally, I'll dump it on somebody's head, and I say, listen, get out a letter of acknowledgement for every one of these letters. And I've even tried to put in systems where every time a letter came in, a card went out, and so forth, so we at least got an acknowledgement going on the line. These things have a tendency to fold up, mostly because the operation can always use more people than it has. Everybody's always doing more work than he ought to be doing. And you all of a sudden set up somebody doing this. And somebody will steal that person. It's a very difficult thing. Yet it is a thing which has to be done and which must be corrected. Why? Because it's the worst thing you could do to anybody. This is really an awful thing to do to people. They expect some part of the communication formula to occur, and it doesn't occur. That's the worst thing that can happen. Now, the only reason I ran over this lamentable situation is this. As we look this over, we find out that the non-arrival of the communication is more potent than the arrival of the communication. So we have the reverse. We've got a gap of nothingness on the communication line, which is worse than a jam on it. So we get the other auditing sin. The other auditing sin. And the other auditing sin is to leave a part of the communication formula unperformed. Now, if I thought I was auditing everybody via the mail line, we would be much more exact. But my computation is trying to fit in my time and everything I can do. This also applies to auditing. My time and everything I can do must be apportioned to the most important functions. Otherwise, we run out of time with rapidity, just by number of pieces of this and that. See? So what comes first is alertness to the forward progress of the science, and what comes next is the immediate concerns, which are organizational, and what comes next is state of preclears anywhere and anywhere, but particularly in the center and in the immediate area. And what comes after that is the state of training. State of training. Let's make it better. Let's check up on it. Let's look it over. Let's see how we can beef it up.